Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1331, Conversations with Monty, conversation number 5. This is being recorded on June 22nd of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to introduce again my new co-host, Monty. And Monty is someone who, when he is unpacking his research for us, and he has put all of the programs that I've done and the written articles and everything under his belt, so that's a foundation for what he does. But when he does what he does, I consider myself to be a student of his work. So, Monty, once again, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you, David. Happy.
And I was reading the Western print edition of the New York Times today, which I guess could be considered something of an exercise in masochism in and of itself. And I have yet to read the article, but it talked about a new television series on something, Hulu or HBO or something, called The Boys. And the brief introductory paragraph said it's one of a growing number of programs talking about what would happen if fascism came to America, or discussing fascism coming to America. And I couldn't help but gag looking at that, and I said, well, you know, what if, huh? One of the things that's interesting to me, Monty, is that this is a society that grew up with television, and people have a tendency to think, well, there was the 60s, and then you turn a channel or the program ends and there's a whole new program, and now it's that 70s show, and then the 80s and the 90s and so on. What you have been presenting to us might be termed the sweep of history, or the sweep of events, or the sweep of institutions. Fascism is presented to us as an aberration. It was a weird occurrence, and now everything is okay. And what you have been unpacking for us is the continuity between powerful institutions, between the world wars, powerful people and institutions during the world war committing treason, Alan Dulles, Prince Max Egan from Hohenlohe, about whom we'll be hearing more in this program, and through him, Walter Schellenberg, in charge of foreign intelligence for the SS. And then we have Winston Scott, who is networking with Max Egan von Hohenlohe in the immediate aftermath of World War II, and then in what might be considered perhaps the ultimate act of treason, we've got Alan Dulles sitting on the Warren Commission, and when Jim Garrison and the New Orleans DA began heroically investigating the assassination of JFK, one of the people who cropped up was, drumroll fanfare, Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe, who was working in Mexico for the CIA and inevitably networking with the very same Winston Scott who was working with von Hohenlohe in the aftermath of World War II. And beyond that, they are in turn networking with Los Pecos, the Mexican Nazi movement that preceded World War II and that morphed into the Latin American death squads and became a key element of propaganda and psychological warfare for, again, the CIA in Mexico. And that's the same Mexico City that Lee Harvey Oswald was visiting, and or people representing themselves as Lee Harvey Oswald. And instead of presenting us with a single event and saying, well, gee, that was weird, wasn't it? you've been demonstrating to us that It is extremely distasteful, but a word that I love is networking, not conspiracy or conspiracy theory, but networking. And these networks are very deep. They involve aristocracies that go back centuries and dominant forces that rule the political landscape today. So with that characteristically wordy introduction, Monty, perhaps you could fill us in some more with Max von Hohenlohe and perhaps what he was doing with Sophindus and the many, many shores on which Lake von Hohenlohe laps, so to speak.
Of course.
By Karina.
Well, once again, this is a little over-the-counter radio. We're doing some engineering adjustments on the fly here, so I guess the operant phrase is, please don't shoot the piano player, he's doing the best he can. So once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to present Monty. Now, the name of the book, and then proceed to demonstrate its relevance to what we've been talking about.
Okay, Dave. The name of the book is Go-Betweens for Hitler. And the author of that book is Karina Urbach, last name spelled U-R-B-A-C-H. Its paperback was published in 2017 through Oxford University Press, first edition 2015, also Oxford University Press. And the significance of what I'm going to be referencing inside of this book is the Habsburg aristocracy, specifically Hohenlohe, and his connections to not only British intelligence and American intelligence, primarily an operative by the name of Alan Dulles, who was the head of the OSS station in Switzerland during the Second World War and later the longest serving director of the Central Intelligence Agency, plus the first chief of covert action for the CIA. But also Hohenlohe's purpose within the superstructure of an entity called Sophindus, which was a covert front run by the Gestapo and primarily Hermann Göring's four-year plan that was concerned with the purchasing of bulk materials through Franco Spain. And before I actually get into the bulk of the Hohenlohe material, if you wouldn't mind, David, I'm going to read directly from a British intelligence document. This is document series number within the British National Security Action Archives. It's only titled by a numeric reference, so I'll just read that off. This is National Security Archives Covert Operations Reference Number KV2/825. I'll read that reference number again. That's KV2/825 is the reference number within the British National Security Archives. Okay. You're not going to find this in the American archives. And I'll go ahead and post a link to this once the program is set on Spitfire list. But, quoting August 1945, this is the final interrogation report of an SS brigade Fuhrer by the name of Batchelef, last name B-A-E-C-H-L-E. And this is his description of what the Sophindus organization was as reported to British intelligence in August of 1945. Quote, the Sophindus organization. This organization, Sociedad Peninsulara Industrial, was started at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War by Bernhard Johans, with a large sum of money supplied by the German government. It was a Nazi organization created for the purpose of supplying Franco with war materials. Later, its function was reversed, and it conducted economic exploitation of Spain for the benefit of Germany. During the Civil War, it gained control of many mines, commercial firms, and agricultural organizations, which it continued to run even during their return to nominal Spanish control. I'd like to stop there and just make it very clear that there was, in fact, a Gestapo hierarchy within Sophindus with Hermann Göring as the commander of the organization. And for those of you that are probably, you know, historians or students of history, specifically the Third Reich, you're probably asking yourself, well, why would Hermann Göring be commanding Gestapo operatives? He was the head of the Luftwaffe. Well, as a point of fact, Hermann Göring was the creator of the Gestapo. Okay. So continuing, reading again from this document, quote, during the Civil War, Sofintis operated under the name HISMA Lit. That's HISMA. Argo was the agricultural branch of Sofintis. So HISMA was the German branch during the Spanish Civil War. Argo was its agricultural concern. Continuing with the document. SS Obersturmbannführer Mosig, that's Mosig spelled M-O-S-I-G, was a Gestapo agent who worked under Bernhard as head of the personnel section in charge of administration of personnel, also supervising their conduct. Mosig was planted in Sofintis by Lindenberg's anti-Nazi movement. Bashek does not know if Sofintis engaged in any intelligence activities. The chief of Sofintis organization for exploitation of Spain, Madrid, was Johannes F. Bernhardt, end quote. So this is the actual final intelligence assessment of British intelligence and Sofintis' connections to what is called GIS within this reference, as German Intelligence Service. So on the face of it, Dave, for the edification of your audience, Sofintis is in fact, in its original purpose, an entity set up by the Nazi government to support the Spanish Civil War, the Franco side of the Spanish Civil War. But by 1935, its whole mission has been flipped. And in turn, it is a Gestapo apparatus run by Hermann Göring to, in fact, exploit all of the Spanish colonies.
By the way, Hermann Göring was a very decorated fighter pilot in World War One. He also was one of the charter members of the Nazi Party under Hitler. So it is not surprising that Göring, who eventually became Reichsmarshal, would be someone who was involved in that capacity. Also, someone's anti-Nazi network, von Lindenberg's anti-Nazi network. I'm confused by that reference, Monty.
Well, I will. I'm glad you brought that up, David. I will come back to that. That's actually a misnomer. British intelligence did not realize that this anti-Nazi network that existed within Sofintis was actually a front for Walter Schellenberg in order to penetrate British intelligence. You know, it was sold to the British as being an anti-Nazi network within the Austrian Free Party movement. But it's actually a front for the Reich's main security command under Schellenberg. And I'll get to that in a few moments once I reference the Holonoi materials within Urbach's book.
Okay, go ahead.
So before I do that, I'd also like to reference one more document. This document was prepared, 15 November 1948. You'll find this within the CIA National Security Archive. So this is our NARA archives, the National Archive Records Administration, Central Intelligence Agency, Joint Intelligence Group, Joint Staff for the Deputy Director of the CIA, published 15 November 1948. And I'll just go ahead and read the NARA number for anybody that wants to reference this. Once again, I will, in fact, put a link to this in Spitfire. But this is CIA number RDP. Reading again, RDP 78-01617A-0015-000-2-0001-2. Okay. That is the NAR number that you will find this document within the National Archives Record Administration. And reading from it, the document is just titled Spain. And this is an intelligence report that was prepped for, at that time, the newly formed Joint Staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which was created under the National Security Act of 1947. It appears that this document was also distributed to the newly formed Atomic Energy Commission, and the newly formed Director of Intelligence for the Secretary of State Research and Intelligence for the Department of State, which actually was an organization called the OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination, which was a function of the CIA. So this is an internal memorandum for the CIA about Spanish intelligence. And I'll skip down to page 15 of this document, section 2, and it's just titled External Spanish Possessions. And I'll read it in its entirety if you don't mind, David.
Sure, go ahead.
So, quote, although Spain's importance as a colonial power ceased after the Spanish-American War, Spain controls the protectorate of Morocco and possesses three small territories and several islands off the Atlantic coast of Africa. They are the Altomunas, Pino de Videla de Garmores, and Chifanjeras Islands off of the Morocco coast. Infre, the enclave of French Morocco off the Atlantic Ocean, Rio de Oro includes Spanish Sahara and the Sique El Jarmariz, Spanish Guinea, including Rio Marit, Los Abrés, Corsicos, Fernando de Poy, and Anapos Islands. The colonies and the protectorate are administered by the military under the Directorate of Morocco and the colonies. These areas are generally economic liabilities rather than assets for Spain. A large part of the cost of administration has been borne by the central government, and the value of raw materials supplied to Spain up to the present has been exceeded by the value of foodstuffs and manufactured goods supplied by Spain. Within the past year, however, the government has begun to take serious cognizance of the potentialities of these regions. In late 1947, construction was commenced of a 200-watt radio broadcasting station in Fernandopo Island. When completed, this station will be an important link for Spain's propaganda network, particularly its Hispanidad program, which is run by the DGS, the State Spanish Intelligence Service. In January 1948, an aerial survey of Spanish Guinea was made by the cabinet ministers, and the funds appropriated for the development of two seaports, Bata on the mainland of Rio Mune and Santa Isabel in Fernando Tipo Island. Trial air service between Madrid and Spanish Guinea reportedly has taken place. Scientific expeditions have been dispatched to outlying areas. Spain has always been interested in North Africa. The cities of Ceuta and Melilla have been administered since 1640 and 1470, respectively, as Spanish cities, although physically located within Morocco. In 1904, the Spanish-French Treaty recognized the integrity of the Moroccan Empire and established special rights of each nation therein, which actually was equivalent to the creation of two zones of influence. Negotiations in 1912 provided that the Sultan of be represented by a caliph and Tutan in the seat of the Spanish Commissioner General. Titular chief of government only, the caliph has no genuine governing powers, and Spanish Morocco in reality under military occupation with 66,000 troops, half of them natives, end quote. So, in effect, what you have here is a Central Intelligence Agency report that is spelling out that the occupied territories of Morocco, controlled by Spain, are in fact entities administered by Spanish state intelligence within the DGS. Now, why is all this information important? Well, the deputy commander of SOFINDIS, Walter Mozeg, and the chief of the German counterpart of SOFINDIS, which I mentioned earlier, is an entity called HISMA. He was the Gestapo liaison to the DGS for the occupied territories in Morocco. And this position continued all the way to 1968.
1968. See, again, people think, well, this stuff was all long ago and far away and gee whiz, you know, who cares now? In other words, right about the time that Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were being assassinated.
And the deputy administrator of SOFINDIS and their chief of personnel intelligence was, in fact, the DGS administrator for Spanish-occupied Morocco.
And by the way, Spanish-occupied Morocco was the geographical launching base, so to speak, was it not, for Francisco Franco? And he actually made use of large numbers of Moroccan colonial troops in his insurrection against the Republican government in Spain.
That is correct. At least 30,000 North African native Moroccans were used in that insurrection.
So, again, an interesting bit of history as it is, as opposed to history as presented by the New York Times.
Correct. And as I pointed out in the previous program, and I'll bring this up again, the man that, by all accounts, created the very first rat line for Nazi intelligence agents into Juan Perón's Argentina was, in fact, a French fascist that was a member of the CALGUA organization, or Action Francois, which was its official name, a man by the name of Charles Lescott, who was a very close associate of Walter Mossack, the chief administrator of DGS intelligence in Spanish Morocco. So just consider that for a moment, that the very first identifiable rat lines run for Nazi intelligence was in fact controlled by a liaison officer of SOFINDIS in Spanish Morocco.
And by the way, the CAGOULE, spelled CAGOULE, is one of the most prominent French fascist organizations. They were involved in an abortive coup attempt against the Social Front of Léon Blum, and they had strong links to the Vichy government and to extensions of these networks in the post-World War II period, running right up through, my favorite word, the milieu of the assassination of JFK, as discussed in the book Coup in Dallas by the late Hank Albarelli.
Correct. So now I'd like to jump forward to the book Go-Betweens for Hitler by Karina Urbach, once again, Oxford University Press. And this is chapter 6 of the book, and I'm just going to read it in its entirety until I reach a stopping point, if I may, David.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so this is chapter 6, this chapter is titled Munich to Marbella, Prince Max Egan und Holonoy Langenberg. Reading. Quote, Prince Max Holonoy usually receives a walk-on part in books about secret intelligence during the Second World War. Authors dedicate a few lines to him, mentioning that he was working in Czechoslovakia in 1938, and during the war was involved in talks with allies in Switzerland. It never seems to be quite clear with for whom he actually worked, Goering or Goering's rival Himmler, or perhaps the German spy chief, Admiral Canaris. The British journalist, Stefan Delmar, who knew Hitler's entourage immediately in the 1930s, was adamant that Max Holonoy worked as an amateur agent for Ribbentrop. The Foreign Office did not share this interpretation, but saw him as a useful go-between nonetheless. The vagueness about his affiliation certainly helped Holonoy to survive turbulent times unscathed. As a result, some interpretations of him are to this day surprisingly friendly, culminating with his German Wikipedia entry that portrays him as a man who promoted peace. Even the United Kingdom National Archives described him rather generously as a Scarlet Pimpernel figure. Digging deeper into this work, it becomes clear that he certainly never recused innocence from the guillotine. There are several plausible reasons why Max Holonoy is seen in a positive light. First, the fact that his private papers have not been made available by the Holonoy family. To this day, they are in fact classified. Continuing. Only selective parts were seen by the journalist Heinz Hohn in the 1960s.
By the way, Heinz Hohn was the co-author of the book, The Order of the Death's Head, about
correct,
the SS, and also he was the author of Order of the Death's Head and co-author of The General Was a Spy, one of the better books about Reinhard Gehlen.
Thank you. Hohne worked for the German magazine Der Spiegel and was the first journalist to contact Prince Max Holonoy. Second, Holonoy had an interest in being interviewed. After the war, he was naturally eager to set the record straight, portraying himself as an early critic of Hitler. His written replies to Hoene's questions are intriguing. He claimed he had never been connected with Himmler's SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, security service. He probably was not aware of the fact that Hoene had unearthed his SD number. So reading that again, Hoene had actually positively identified Holonoy as a member of the SD.
And by the way, the SD was the SS intelligence service, the Sicherheitsdienst. Go ahead, Moppy.
Correct. Continuing. Instead, Max Holonoy claimed that he acted as a private individual who happened to know several leading people in Germany, the West, including Churchill and Alan Dulles. He concluded that he had talked to Hitler at the Olympics in 1936 and therefore got to know Ribbentrop, Göring, Himmler, and Ambassador Hevel, a Nazi diplomat, and others. I want to stop right there and make it clear to the listening audience. The American guest who shared an opera box of Adolf Hitler at the 1936 Olympics was at that time the president of international affairs for Chase Manhattan Bank, John J. McCloy, later military administrator of West Germany.
And also a member of the Warren Commission, along with Alan Dulles, who was networking with Max Egan von Hohenlohe in early 1943, when von Hohenlohe was an emissary of the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, an organization with whom he supposedly was not involved.
Correct. Continuing. Whether some of the people he talked to had belonged to the SD, he could really not say. He claimed to have cared about one thing only, persuading a member of the Nazi leadership to support his peace plans. From this end alone, he stressed that he had worked before and after the outbreak of the war with the Nazis. Max Holonoy's son, Alfonso, later concluded that this narrative, describing his father as a, quote, an independent and trustworthy mediator between several fronts, a true European, end quote. At the time, European interrogation was a politically correct line of argument. Apart from his son, another man made sure that Max Holonoy was seen in the most favorable light. His name was Reinhard Spitzy, last name spelled S-P-I-T-Z-Y. Spitzy was a dedicated Nazi who fully identified himself with Holonoy. In his memoirs, he portrayed him as a seeker of peace. Spitzy's books were popular in post-war Germany because he was a highly prominent talking head in TV documentaries. Witty, charming, and rotten to the core, his expertise was saucy stories about Hitler's private life. It was therefore due to Spitzy that Max Holonoy became a good Nazi. He was certainly a very shrewd one. It was his shrewdness that turned him into a go-between. And now there's a little bit of history here about Holonoy's background. I'm going to go ahead and skip some of that because it's not prudent to the narrative. So skipping forward to same chapter, chapter 6, Munich to Marbella. This is page 282 of the book. Correction, 281 of the book. And it talks about Holonoy's connections to the British aristocracy. So reading about his sister, Stephanie. Stephanie, the House of Holonoy, was divided into several branches. Because of their connections with the British royal family, the Protestant branch of the Holonoy Lannenbergs had a high status. They were, however, not a very rich family, and Queen Victoria had more than once helped them out financially. She did not help the Catholic Holonoy Langenberg line, though, of which Max was a member. Money was certainly a problem for the socially ambitious man like him. His prospects of one day running at least a moderate estate collapsed completely in 1918. Until then, he had been serving in the Austrian army and enjoyed a social status of his family. After the war, he faced a social and financial abyss. His father's property was situated in a newly founded Czechoslovakia, threatened to be diminished by agrarian reforms. It is therefore not surprising that Holonoy deeply resented the Czech government, but the Holonoy family motto was Ex Flammis Orator, I will rise out of the flames, and Max would make sure of that. skipping down, once again, this talks a little bit about his background, what he's doing in between the wars. That's not pertinent to what we're looking at, so I'm going to skip forward to the end of, or the beginning of page 283, forward, quote. His friend Spitzy would later recall, Max Holonoy made to think on a European scale since his ancestors worked all over Europe, producing, according to Holonoy, a German chancellor, a French marshal, a Roman Catholic cardinal, and a number of Austro-Hungarian field marshals, generals of Prussia and Baden, the hereditary of the marshals of Württemberg, and the ADC's general to the Russian Tsar, all immediate family members of Holonoy. Holonoy got involved with foreign affairs because this is what his family had done since the Middle Ages. Indeed, Max's eyes, there seemed to have been a natural continuity. Generations of his family had served monarchs and popes. He would now serve a new prince, Adolf Hitler. The reasons why he chose Hitler were purely opportunistic. They were also quite common amongst his peer group. As we have seen, 3 points of Hitler's foreign policy were highly attractive to the German and Austrian aristocrats who had been landowners in several countries. Hitler's anti-Czech policy, his plans for Austria, the policy towards Poland. In 1934, no less, a person than Goebbels fought for property for the princely Pless family confiscated by the Polish nationalists. It was an act that made impression on aristocrats. The Nazi party seemed supportive when it came to the grievances of the imperial families of Europe.
Marty, I have a question. Was that Goebbels, the Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister of the Third Reich?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that is the individual we're talking about there. Yes, go ahead.
100%. Yeah, Pless, and the Pless family were extended family members of the Holonoy, the Polish branch of the Holonoy family. Continuing. Max Holonoy Langenberg was not particularly interested in Poland, but in two foreign policy issues on Hitler's agenda were of great importance to him. First of all, the Fuhrer promised him a new awakening of an old idea, a greater Germany. At long last, Austria and Germany might become united. Reinhard Spitzi, himself an Austrian, wrote how much the idea of a greater Christian Germany meant to his friend Holonoy. Max was a tough and clever singer with with immense charm. He was a convincing patriot of the old and the greater new Germany under the Nazis. Hitler offered something else that was irresistible, an aggressive policy towards Czechoslovakia. Holonoy was only one of many former Austro-Hungarian landowners who had developed a hatred towards the Czech nationalist government. In the 1920s, two aristocratic groups emerged in Czechoslovakia, the German and the Chetswans. When the German group consisted of two-thirds of the whole aristocracy, the Czechs were only covered in one-third. They immersed themselves in Czech culture, took Czech passports, and made their arrangements with the Republic. These aristocrats naturally had a greater chance of being integrated with the new Czechoslovakia than aristocrats who made their pro-German leanings obvious. However, in the 1920s, both groups were sympathetic to fascist ideas. They saw themselves as an ideal counterweight to Bolshevism and liberalism. Though they all favored fascism per se, not everyone could agree with the Nazis, because Hitler seemed determined to break up Czechoslovakia. The gap between the German and Czech groups of aristocrats consequently widened. It was a divide that is still playing out today in aristocratic circles, each faction accusing the other of their ancestors, siding with the Nazis, the Czech Republic, or later, the communists.
And by the way, I would point out that there is no more Czechoslovakia. During World War II, the country was broken up into Slovakia and I forgot what the Czech country became. But the Slovakia was dominated by the Hlinka party, H-L-I-N-K. It was explicitly fascist. And today, there's no more Czechoslovakia. There's Slovakia and the Czech Republic. Go ahead, Monty.
Thank you, David. For the German group, Hitler represented in the 1930s a bulwark against their two greatest enemies, Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union, allies from 1935. The fear of communism was an enormous driving force for Holonoy and his friends. And the Sudeten crisis of 1938, the British foreign officer advised Frank Ashton Galvik pointed this out. Quote, "They have a horror of Russia and Bolshevism, which they believe is the real danger to them, to what is left of their possessions, and to the tradition for which they still stand," end quote. To protect their possessions, the German group of aristocrats sided with Konrad Henlein, the leader of the German minority in Czechoslovakia of the so-called Sudeten Germans. What happened to Czechoslovakia in the summer and autumn of 1938 is to be discussed. We have seen how Stephanie Holonoy and Wildermann tried to influence Halifax. Max Holonoy had an identical brief, and he was carried it out with the utmost finesse. Long after the war, his old friend Spitzy was still enjoying the coup they pulled off in 1938. It was easy for our friend and benefactor, Prince Max Holonoy Langenberg, to use his excellent contacts in the West to promote the case of the Sudeten Germans. After the war, Holonoy claimed that he had worked on his own and that it was his aim to prevent a war over Czechoslovakia. It was the same narrative that Stephanie Holonoy had used to describe her involvement. Both could hardly admit that Hermann Göring was their point of contact and, in fact, running them. It remained a closely kept secret. The Czechs, as well as the British, were under the misapprehension that Holonoy had been their itinerary to Helheim and not to Göring. Max Holonoy's role was to poison Britain as a moderate, the voice of reasoning, helping the British solve their thorny problem of the Sudetenland. It might seem surprising that when he was listened to in London, but the Foreign Office had a history of being in contact with German Czechs nobles. Shortly after World War I, the Czech socialist press had even suspected that the British were colluding with the local aristocrats to install a king. The Czech newspaper, Klistolvo, wrote, quote, "Aristocrats are conspiring to place a king on the throne of Bohemia, in which a connection with the HRH, Prince Arthur of Kolonak, is alluded to," end quote. The paper went on to say that members of the British, French, and Italian diplomatic and military missions are too often seen at the houses of nobility, in particular, the Prince Friedrich Lobenvik of Czech Republic. Though the idea of a king was far-fetched, the visits to princely houses never stopped. British diplomats had forged good contact with the local aristocracy, and these contacts lasted into the 1930s. Holonoy was eager to use them for his own purposes. He and Hermann Göring knew all too well that a go-between with an impressive pedigree would be appreciated in a class-conscious society like Britain. Indeed, Neville Chamberlain in Halifax preferred to talk to somebody with an impeccable background. Holonoy seemed to be a familiar type, a grand seigneur of the old school, whose country seat just happened to be in Bohemia and not the Shires. As an international aristocrat, he was obviously as much at home in Britain as in Paris or Vienna or Madrid. He was independently wealthy and a jovial man, an ideal interlocker. He knew Churchill and members of the Foreign Office and the intelligence services and many foreign diplomats in London, including the American OSS station chief, Winston Scott.
And of course, we have him networking with von Hohenlohe in the immediate aftermath of World War II. And then he is networking with von Hohenlohe and Los Tecos and the Mexico City contingent involved with the assassination of JFK, that obviously in the early 60s.
Correct. Many foreign diplomats in London considered them friends of Holonoy, including Churchill's distant relative, the Duke of Alba, and the number two at the German embassy, Prince Otto von Bismarck II. In retrospect, the Foreign Office of Britain commented on his work to the Sudetenland. Quote, He is very active as an intermediary of Goering and other so-called moderate Germans before the Munich Agreement. End quote. I can't believe that the British Foreign Office described Goering as a moderate German, but there it is.
I guess during the Battle of Britain, he wouldn't have appeared so moderate.
Correct. Continuing. By then, it might have dawned on the Foreign Office that the moderate Germans led by Hermann Goering never actually existed. But in 1938, Hollenoy seemed an ideal intermediary, a man who would help to prevent trouble in Czechoslovakia. The British government had not acted against the annexation of Austria in March of 38 and hoped for no more aggravation in regard to Czechoslovakia. Assurances were given by Hollenoy. To his sister, Chamberlain had written, quote, "If we can avoid another violent coup in Czechoslovakia, which ought to be feasible, it may be possible for Europe to settle down again and someday for us to start peace talks with the Germans," end quote. Chamberlain thought that this was feasible because, amongst other things, he had back channels with the Germans, primarily Hollenoy. The prime minister had already made up his mind in Czechoslovakia. He had not much patience with the Czech president,
Edward Beneš,
whom he distrusted. In his opinion, the Czechs should solve the Sudeten problem quickly and spare the French from having to fulfill their guarantee to Czechoslovakia in case of a war. He was in denial of the fact that the Sudeten problem was just a pretext being used by Hitler, and Goering to acquire the whole of Czechoslovakia with Hollenoy as their point of contact, defusing the British. Chamberlain also did not recognize that the Sudeten German leader, Himmler, was from the beginning Hitler's puppet. After a meeting with the Führer in March of 1938, Himmler stepped up instructions that he had been given, quote, "We must always demand so much that we cannot be satisfied by any concession from the British," end quote. As Vada Steinger rightly pointed out, such instructions were unknown to London, Paris, and Prague, made a mockery out of the subsequent French efforts to find an acceptable solution to the Sudeten problem. In fact, what happened during the summer of 1938 was a long theater of performance with an excellent cast of German go-betweens. Max Hollenoy had a good character role playing the well-meaning friend of the British who just wanted to help. Apart from Max, another excellent performance was given by Stephanie Hollenoy. Like Max, she sold Helen to the British as a man whose demands for autonomy were reasonable.
You know, I like the use of the term players. It goes with the television metaphor that I was using earlier at the beginning of the program. But this is something I want to pause here, Monty.
Of course.
To drive home to the audience not only the enormity of who and what Max von Hollenoy was, whether he's networking with Alan Dulles in early 43, or networking with Win Scott and the JFK assassination milieu and the CIA in the early 1960s. But here, he is working with Neville Chamberlain. He is a cat's paw from the Third Reich to Neville Chamberlain, helping to arrange the partition of Czechoslovakia. And one point I want to make, and this is covered in the book The Nazis Go Underground, available for download for free on the Spitfire website. Neville Chamberlain is generally presented as a well-meaning dupe. You know, he just got outfoxed by the Nazis. Neville Chamberlain was not only a protege of Sir Montague Norman, head of the Bank of England, who funded Adolf Hitler. He was a supporter of Hitler, but he also was heavily invested in Imperial Chemicals, the dominant British chemical company that was an important cartel partner of IG Farben. So it's not like Neville Chamberlain was just this sort of a dim-witted or naive diplomat. He was well connected, and we see Max Hohenlohe, who, the more time passes, the more I'm seeing him as having more connections than a switchboard, a major player in not only 20th century politics, but a major player in international fascism from the period from between the World Wars through World War II, through the Cold War, the CIA, and the assassination of JFK, which we spoke about in, for the record, 1327 and 1328. Go ahead, Moppy.
And I should note, just as a tack on, as I noted in our first program about Hohenlohe, never forget that Max Egan von Hohenlohe, according to British intelligence documents, is in fact the top purchasing agent for the Nazi-occupied forces in France of Sofindis. So never forget, he's also a Sofindis operative.
and he was raising the funds used to feed the Axis occupation forces in Spain, who were fighting the Allies. That would include the father of Bill Clinton's chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Saakashvili, whose father was in a Georgian, that's Georgia as in the USSR, not Georgia as in Ray Charles. He was in a Georgian Waffen-SS unit that was fighting the American forces who landed on Utah and Omaha Beach on D-Day, which is... So his rations came through Sofindis and Max von Hohenlohe.
Right, right. And as I pointed out in a previous program, Hohenlohe was in fact the purchasing agent for all of the foodstuffs that were provided to the Nazi occupation forces in Normandy. So, I mean, we can thank him for that. Continuing, though, with the go-betweens for Hitler, Karina Urbach, Chapter 6, I'm now on page 285, reading. Apart from Max, another excellent performance was given by Stephanie Hohenlohe. Like Max, she sold Helen to the British as a man whose demands for autonomy were reasonable. As had been shown, Stephanie was Helen's hostess in London in May of 1938. A month after Helen had demanded political autonomy for his people in a major speech at Carlsbad.
Now, wasn't that Conrad Heinlein? Am I remembering correctly?
Heinlein, right. Conrad Heinlein. Yeah.
Go ahead.
His demands were more or less aimed at the disintegration of Czechoslovakia. But despite this speech, he was well received in London. With the knowledge of Halifax and Chamberlain, Heinlein had talked to Van Strutt and Churchill. After selling Heinlein as an upright politician to the London stage, Goering and Hitler had used a go-between in July to bring home to Chamberlain how serious the situation in Sudetenland could become if the British ignored Heinlein's demands. As we know, Waldemann had visited Halifax privately with Stephanie Hohenlohe and told him that if nothing was done about the problem, Hitler would start a war. While Waldemann and Stephanie were busy in London, other go-between, Max Hohenlohe, was busy in Czechoslovakia feeding the British with his own Sudeten German spin. His point of contact was Sir Robert Van Strutt, until earlier that year, the permanent undersecretary of the Foreign Office. Van Strutt, despite his anti-German stance, was also interested in solving the Sudeten question peacefully. He trusted Max Hohenlohe and had sent one of his best men to liaison with him, a Captain Malcolm Christie. Christie was an intelligence officer who befriended lots of leading Nazis over the years. In Van Strutt and Christie's eyes, Max Hohenlohe was the man who they could do business with. To keep their conversations confidential, they chose a code name for each other. Christie's code name was Graham, and Gordon was Max Hohenlohe's, while Smiler, which might have something to do with his sunny disposition, Heinlein was called Chicken, a translation of his German name. In July of 1938, Christie reported on his conversation with Smiler. Quote, Prince Hohenlohe rang up and expressed anxiety about the Czech tactics. Hohenlohe is absolutely convinced, and I am equally so, that nothing short of a reasonable measure of the cultural autonomy for the Sudeten Germans would do. Holonoy feels that it would require at least such an offer to take the wind out of Germany's sails to undermine her pretext for intervention, end quote. This sounded as if Holonoy genuinely wanted to help the British against a bellicose Hitler. In fact, he knew that Hitler did not want autonomy for the Sudetenland, but to annex it. It was the ultimate aim, but Holonoy rightly calculated that the British would not accept this outright. They had to be persuaded slowly, and they needed to help save face with the French. There were at least two reasons why Goering and his go-between Holonoy worked so hard on the British to achieve a peaceful annexation for the Sudetenland. First of all, Hermann Goering genuinely feared the reactions of the Western powers if Hitler simply marched into the Sudetenland. But apart from the external threat, there was also an internal one. Goering knew all too well that the Führer's plan for Czechoslovakia, codename Case Green, had been criticized by some of his own generals. They feared a political and military disaster. Indeed, the Czech army was not weak. It had been increased over the years, and importantly, most of the Czech fortifications were situated in the Sudetenland. Goering hoped that if the Sudetenland could be handed over by peaceful means, Czechoslovakia would lose a majority of its border fortifications. German soldiers could simply take over the fortifications without a shot being fired. After that, occupying the rest of Czechoslovakia would be plain sailing. Hitler knew, and he had supported Waldheim and Stephanie Holonoy channel to Halifax, and he probably knew that Goering was running another back channel with Max Egan Holonoy. To this day, his actions in the summer of 1938 puzzle historians. He seemed determined to carry out his Case Green and attack Czechoslovakia either way, but it also had periods of doubt. He was not sure how the British would react, and therefore it was important for him to get as much information via go-betweens as possible. Consequently, people like Max Holonoy, as a full-fledged Gestapo and SD operative, were extremely useful.
By the way, Muppy, we are almost out of time. I got my timer started a little late here.
Sure.
So we're going to wrap things up pretty soon. I want to apologize to both you and the audience for the engineering bumps here. We're trying out a new technology here where we're doing Zoom through the board. And I just realized that this is the first program I have recorded at KFJC since, for the record, 11/23, which I did on Friday, March 13th of 2020, in the master studio. That was the Friday before the lockdown for COVID. So this is more than 200 programs later. And we can continue with this presentation in the next broadcast. However, we are for all practical purposes, out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 1331. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 5. This is being recorded on June 22nd of the year 2024. I'm Dave Emery for Monty saying thanks for listening.